This is Hazel Kahn with this month's Tidings, where I introduce you to interesting and unusual people from around the world, people who I've been eager to meet. Joining me today on Skype from New York City is Christopher Calderhead, an eminent calligrapher and author, well known in calligraphic and teaching circles in New York and beyond. Welcome, Christopher.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be on the program.
Thank you. Let me tell our listeners a little bit about your background before we go any further. You were trained in the classical calligraphy tradition in England at the Roehampton Institute. Where is the Roehampton Institute?
Roehampton is in South London, due south of Hammersmith. The program at Roehampton, which no longer exists, by the way, was run by a woman named Anne Kemp. And she was a calligrapher who trained in the 40s. And she set up her own calligraphy program at Roehampton, which was not an accredited program, but was a full-time program of calligraphy and bookbinding, both. And I was there for 2 years. And there were a very dedicated group of people who took the classes there. In fact, a lot of prominent English calligraphers came out of that program.
Also, you've been editor of Letter Arts Review for the past 7 years. LAR is an international quarterly that covers the whole range of lettering arts, including calligraphy, lettering, typeface design, and letter-based fine art. I just don't even know if people realize that those things do go together.
But yes, it's a funny mix.
It took me a while to when I understood that bookbinding was part of this overall craft.
So if you're going to study calligraphy in the European tradition, then you are studying something that has its origins in the Middle Ages, and it was predominantly a book art. So the great manuscripts we look at are books. And that's very different from China or Japan, where the great works are often scrolls. That's not really part of the Western tradition until very recently.
Okay, well, we've sort of digressed a bit. You are doing a second expanded edition of your book, Illuminating the Word, The Making of the St. John's Bible. And sorry, it's just been published, I believe.
Just been published, yes. Mm-hmm.
And then also you've written the books Calligraphy Studio and with Holly Cohen, The World Encyclopedia of Calligraphy. Mm. And these days you are teaching calligraphy and design at the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And also, you've recently been featured in a book by Cynthia Dantzig called 100 New York Calligraphers. I imagine it's 100 best New York calligraphers.
I hope so, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen the book. It just came out.
Mm. Well, congratulations for that. Is there an English tradition and is there an American tradition of calligraphy?
Absolutely, definitely. English calligraphy has connections to 1,000 years of English culture. And there are distinct styles of calligraphy in the English Middle Ages that you can tell manuscripts were written in England. And there's also a social need for calligraphy in the sense that the government needs documents for the queen to sign, and calligraphers have to make that kind of thing. So there's a kind of sense of continuity in the culture that shapes English calligraphy very strongly. The United States doesn't have any kind of tradition like that. We've come from all over the world and brought all sorts of traditions from the countries we came from. And some of that involves calligraphy. So American calligraphy has always been a very diverse practice, and it's always been a very commercial practice, really. Mm-hmm. So that people who were calligraphers in this country during the 20th century tended to work in graphic design and to do book jackets for major publishers and things like that. And that was the highest end of the work. There's also a real sense of diversity within the United States. So people from Oregon have a very specific kind of school of calligraphy based on one teacher, Lloyd Reynolds. You can tell that they come out of that school. Mm. The New York school is more defined by some European traditions and has influences both from Germany and also from England, but also from world traditions.
You mean non-European as well?
That's right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess there are things like Hebrew, Arabic, and things like that.
Well, that's right. So, so if you're in New York, obviously, and you're aware of calligraphy, you're aware of Hebrew calligraphy, because there's such a strong Jewish community in New York. And so you see Hebrew calligraphy around. I have contacts, certainly, with Arabic calligraphers throughout the Middle East, so not just the Arab lands, but also Iran and parts of Pakistan and so on, where they use that alphabet. Or variations of that alphabet, and also the whole East Asian tradition with the brush. Very prominent. I love going down to Chinatown, for instance, and you can go to small bookstores there and you can buy all your calligraphy tools and calligraphy manuals for Chinese. It's wonderful.
It's all the brushes and the inks and stuff as well.
Mm. Yeah.
So let's, before we go any further, let's start with actually defining calligraphy, because I suspect that there are many people for whom calligraphy is nothing much more than beautiful wedding invitations.
Right.
Or perhaps, a diploma of some kind. But I'm sure that by the time you finish talking to them, they'll all know a lot more.
So
what is calligraphy?
Of course, the great challenge is we're on the radio.
I know, it's definitely a non-visual medium we're in.
So it's a good challenge. I think of calligraphy as existing on a spectrum. Handwriting on one hand and lettering on the other hand. Handwriting is over on the left here. Mm-hmm. And handwriting is just regular, ordinary, picking up a pen and writing something mm-hmm. down. The only thing we really care about is, can we read it? It doesn't matter how it looks particularly, but as long as it's legible, we're happy.
Mm-hmm.
If we move right along the spectrum, you get to those people who have very beautiful handwriting, who've really thought about how to take a pen and how to make letter forms that relate to each other, and there's a rhythm to their writing, and all the letters are beautifully constructed. And that begins to slide into the realm of calligraphy. It's not really calligraphy yet, because you're just using an ordinary tool, like a ballpoint pen.
Hmm.
But when you start using more expressive tools, like an edged pen, a chisel-edged pen, or a pointed pen that you dip in ink, or a brush, then in fact, the act of writing becomes something much more self-conscious, concerned with the form of the letters, and that they have an expressive potential in addition to whatever the words say. So calligraphy is basically, it's writing where we're concerned with the form. We're concerned with what it looks like. The word itself comes from the Greek, kalos, meaning beautiful, and graphein, which means to mark or to incise or to etch or to write.
Mm-hmm.
So beautiful writing. But I think we can speak more broadly, simply writing where the form matters. It remains writing, mm-hmm. always. So when you pick up any kind of tool and you dip it in ink or into paint and you begin to write with it, you're making very direct marks on the page. You don't come back and fiddle with them. You know how to make each mark. Each mark is beautifully put down on the page. Now, if we continue down the spectrum, down toward lettering, over on the right-hand side,
mm-hmm.
lettering is much more about something which has been drawn and refined and worked over. So, for instance, I'm working on a project right now where I've drawn the letters for a logo that I'm doing, and I've drawn them with pencil, and then I've put layers of tracing paper over, and I've traced over, and I've refined and refined and refined the letters, and then I've scanned them, and I'm beginning to redraw them now in the computer. Mm. That's not a direct process at all. So it's going to take me 2 days to work up one word. That's what we call lettering.
Mm-hmm.
So calligraphy exists in that in-between place where we care about the forms, but we also write it directly, and it goes directly down onto the page.
And when it's via computer, then what then is called?
Then I would call it lettering,
mm-hmm.
because you're not direct on the computer.
So
I don't call it calligraphy, right? So I make a distinction between lettering and calligraphy.
So it's kind of a hybrid, I suppose.
It is, in a certain way, yes.
I actually had in mind a different continuum, and I was going to ask you about that. Lettering is now at the right-hand end of the continuum, but mm-hmm. then we have art. And we have painting, and we have all those things, and decoration, and craft. Is there somewhere that lettering then continues to the right?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know. I think that's a different matrix to put this on,
mm-hmm.
really. Calligraphy exists somewhere between craft and fine art,
mm-hmm.
and it really depends on what the person wants to make of it. Many calligraphers are just interested in the pure craft of doing beautiful letters.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to be the ones who work in the more traditional scripts, and so very recognizable historical styles. And they're very interested in communicating the text with clarity. So whatever text they have in front of them to write out, they want it to be a beautiful presentation of that text. These are fine words, these are important words, and we want someone to read them. And then, of course, you have the other group of people who are more interested in doing what they consider basically fine art.
Yeah.
And they may not be interested in you reading the text with any kind of ease. So they may push the edges of legibility and then play with the letter forms and be more interested in more expressive mark making and perhaps doing backgrounds with washes of color and things like that. I would like to say something about legibility. Mm-hmm. Legibility is a very interesting question. If you are looking at a text that's up on the wall and it's beautifully written and you can read it right away, if you speak the language and you can read it, you no longer look at it. It interferes with looking at it as a composition because you're so aware of the words. And a lot of times calligraphers like to push the edges of legibility by doing things like slightly distorting the letters or putting the letters very close together, packing them, massing them together, in order to make the writing process slower. And therefore, you may be able to read the words, but you have to puzzle them out a little bit more. And that allows you to engage your visual instincts to look at the shape of what's up there on the page. That's one of the really nice things you can do with calligraphy.
So the calligraphers try to control how long and how involved the viewer is.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Mm. The New York Times used to publish on July 4th. On the back of the first section, they always published the Declaration of Independence. Mm. It was a rendering of the original document. And that document is written in an ordinary secretary hand from the 18th century. Very, very long lines. Every 4th of July, I used to read it in the original document, though. And you do have to slow down. You know, often it's better if you read it out loud because it's hard to read a very, very long line and come back to the beginning again. So that's a nice example of something that, in fact, it is legible, but you do have to work at it a bit.
Every time you take up a pen and you're writing a shopping list or something like that, are you being a calligrapher then?
It depends on the context. Sometimes I actually do sit there and I write a shopping list and care about how it looks just for my own amusement. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, no, a shopping list is practical and I can toss it the moment I get everything I've bought.
Yeah, otherwise you'd have to hold on to it.
Right, exactly, yes.
Yeah. Do you think we've talked enough about history?
History is very important to the approach that I take to this. I've always been interested in the history of culture and thought and art and so on. My training at Roehampton, we looked at medieval manuscripts a lot. And we talked about them and we thought about how they were made and the cultural context in which they were made. So I think history is very important when you talk about calligraphy. It's not the only thing, and it probably does reflect my own interests to some extent. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when I'm teaching students at Pratt, I'm very interested in showing them the origins of our typographic forms, because you can see a direct line between the way our alphabet appears, if you're typing in Times Roman, for instance, and the historical letter forms that underlie that. Now, there's a reason these letters look the way they do. For instance, there's a reason that a capital A in a serif typeface, there's a reason why the capital A has one thick stroke on one side and a thin stroke on the other side. Mm-hmm. And if the thick stroke is on the other side, it's simply wrong. Mm-hmm. It's just not right. And that comes directly out of the pen. And that's one of the things I want my students to understand when they study calligraphy.
Comes directly out of the pen and therefore out of the tradition.
Yes. Certain shapes in the letter forms that we use are direct results of 1,500 years of calligraphy before the printing press was invented. We have continued from the Renaissance, when printing came in, to use those forms, and we have changed them since then, but a lot is dependent on what forms of manuscripts were being made in 1400, 1500.
I was going to ask you whether you can say calligraphy has developed, and if so, what is it that has developed?
I would say that all the letters we use today have their roots in a long, long tradition. Calligraphy didn't stop when the printing press came in, and so it continued to develop. And in the 20th century, we saw some incredible explosions of new ideas in the Western calligraphy world, and new techniques and new ways of going about lettering, because we were exposed to so much more in the world. And in fact, because it no longer had to be a pure craft, it was able to become something that was more of an art form. So we have a much wider range than we would have had 100 years ago.
And what about going to the commercial side? Is that anything to do with what you've just said?
Well, that's a good question. Doing work for commercial projects does affect the kind of work that you do. We've talked a little bit about doing calligraphy and using a computer to help you out. That does shape what kind of letter forms you make and changes your approach to your lettering. Also, now that we are all on computers all the time, people live in a very slick world. And so that's changing people's tastes in calligraphy. Because now what people often value is the more rough quality of something that's clearly handmade, maybe perhaps a little crude. Whereas 50 years ago, I think people would have enjoyed the fact that someone could pick up a pen and make a perfect letter form. Mm-hmm. And that's no longer as valuable.
Do you think that that devalues then the value of calligraphy?
No, but I think it pushes people who are doing commercial style work in a direction which is a little more crude, a little more obviously handmade. I see this in handmade papers, for instance, because I have a small collection of old vintage English handmade papers from the 1950s. They are just beautiful pieces of paper. They're very strong because they're handmade, but they're very thin. But there's nothing about them that advertises that they're handmade. Whereas now you see a lot of handmade papers that are obviously a little coarse and have coarser edges and have all sorts of stuff dumped into them like rose petals. Because people want something that feels, this is handmade.
Christopher Calderhead, a leading calligrapher, author, and teacher, is talking about calligraphy. This is Hazel Kahn with Tidings on WPKN Radio. What happens if you make a mistake in an oil painting or acrylic or even with ink? You can do something to fix it. But when you're doing one of these things that you were talking about, what do you do with mistakes?
Well, that's a good question. If you're making an original thing where you're writing on a piece of paper and that's it, there's only one copy, that's the copy.
Right.
And if you're working on paper and you make a mistake, there are few things you can do. If the paper is very strong, it is possible sometimes to erase the mistake. You allow the ink to dry completely and you can take an electric eraser and very slowly, very carefully rub away. You don't want to have to do this because it's a nuisance. And then, of course, you often raise the fibers. So then you have to take a bone folder and you have to work the fibers down. The fact is, you've marred that piece of paper. It will show under certain light and stuff like that. So you have the opportunity, perhaps, you just rewrite it until you get it right. Some people will use a light table. They'll put the rough draft underneath the nice piece of paper, and then they're writing on top of the nice piece of paper, but they can see the words through, and that helps you not make a mistake.
Is that cheating or not?
No, I don't think that's cheating.
Just wondering how harsh calligraphers are on themselves.
No, I will use any cheap trick I can.
As a teacher and with your students, do you find that there are some recurring myths or misunderstandings of calligraphy when they come in?
I think they're very open to all sorts of ways of approaching calligraphy. Many of them have said they enjoy the simple physical act of writing, that it's so refreshing for them to sit down, pick up a pen, and spend 3 hours in an afternoon writing. And they don't have to do much difficult design work or conceptual work. They're really concentrating on movements of the pen across the page. And so they find it very relaxing. They think of it as meditative. So they do associate it with sort of Zen or something like that.
Because everything else is so frantic.
Right, exactly.
You mentioned movement, bodily movement, right? The way your hand moves. That's part of the shaping of letters. I guess the hands and arms are always involved in all of these things, but there's a more close relationship between movement and calligraphy.
There's an incredibly close relationship because it really is about muscle memory. I always liken calligraphy to learning to play an instrument or learning how to dance. If you're learning how to dance, as long as you're looking at your feet, you're not really dancing, are you? So you have to really internalize the motions in order for you to be able to be fluid and free and write with grace and ease. When I'm writing long text, one of the things I find is that it's not so much that I'm thinking about the shape of the arches of the letters. I'm actually thinking about how it feels. This is how an italic arch feels in my fingertips, physical sensation in my hand, that there's a certain kind of spring and release when I'm writing the italic hand. And that feels very different from when I'm writing a Gothic. And there's a diamond at the top and a straight stroke and a diamond at the bottom. And it's very chopped up, very staccato in its rhythm. Whereas an italic is a fluid rhythm with these little stops in between. Once you get that muscle memory, then in fact, a lot of the other stuff comes together very easily. Your spacing comes much more naturally because you're actually moving your hand in a certain kind of way.
So why do they actually want to study calligraphy? Is it, do they usually have commercial applications in mind?
No, they don't. I teach other things at Pratt as well. So I teach a basic design class with a computer. And it's taken me some time to actually build a reputation amongst the students. And therefore, students have thought, wow, I'd like to do his calligraphy class. But it's not obvious what the commercial application is for the practice of calligraphy.
Other than addressing envelopes for the weddings.
Which is fine. I mean, wedding invitations and envelopes are good bread and butter work. But I always say, no one studies the piano so that they can play at bar mitzvah receptions.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's not why we do these things.
Yeah.
So it's great work, but not really the high end of what we're doing. I admire the people who do it, and it's great stuff. But it's much more interesting to be a little more on the cutting edge of experimentation and having some bigger design challenges to face.
What is the gratification of being a calligrapher? I mean, why do calligraphers do what they do? Why do you do it?
So I think those are two separate questions. Why do students do it? I think they do it because they're interested in this odd thing that they've heard about. And they do enjoy actually the physicality of writing. Mostly right now, I do things for my own pleasure. I just like to sit and write things that I enjoy. Sometimes classic texts, but more often I write my own texts. I've been doing a series of small pieces that involve simply writing down an observation, maybe an observation each day. And each one is on one page, and it's just very directly written in a simple Roman script. I bound these as books, and I just make that for my own pleasure.
Is calligraphy of interest to people other than your students and so on? Or is it growing, or is it in decline? Or
calligraphy had an enormous burst of popularity in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the calligraphy societies got very large. And there was tremendous interest in both traditional and more expressive modern kinds of calligraphy. Through the 90s and the first decade of this century, there was a real dip in interest. It goes along with changes in the graphic art world, computer coming in and really roughing up the whole field. What I do find is more and more young people are interested in calligraphy, and there is a much greater openness to calligraphy as an area of interest.
What are they interested in, just doing it or applying it in some way?
A little of both. I think there's kind of a curiosity about it. This may have to do with the fact that we are becoming much more globalized, and people are much more aware of the great calligraphy traditions that come out of the Arab world and the East Asian world. And just amongst people who are either teaching in the art schools or working as graphic designers, they are too young to remember when calligraphy got tossed from the art schools in the 60s. Mm. And so they don't have the sort of bad associations that it's old and fusty. Mm. When calligraphy was popular in the 80s, that was kind of a countercultural group of people. That was not mainstream art directors as interesting, quirky people who got into this funny, odd field. Two of the other places that are interesting tie-ins between calligraphy and the bigger world are tattoos.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are very interested in distinctive tattoos. It's incredible how much lettering goes on in the tattoo mm-hmm. world. And in fact, I've done designs for people's tattoos. I've done it for individuals, for friends of mine.
You've just done it on a piece of paper?
That's right. Sometimes I've gone with them and watched them get the tattoo. And sometimes they've just taken it off and gotten the tattoo on their own. Incredibly impressed that tattoo people can actually reproduce my lettering with such exactitude. Because some of it's quite small.
What kind of things do people want you to do in calligraphy? Just like their names and stuff? Or
No, usually lines from literature of some kind. Either a line from a song or from a poem or from a novel they read, something like that. The only other thing that actually I would love to touch on is graffiti. Because I think certainly as I walk around the city and I look at graffiti on the streets, especially tags. Tags are written directly. When I look at tags on the street, I really see a commonality between what we do as calligraphers and what the street artists do in the graffiti tradition. That's also a point of contact for my students. It's really important to them. I like to show them works that I've photographed, just things on the street where someone has written on a wall. The sense of beautiful curves that repeat throughout the tag can be really magnificent. And actually, I can put that next to pieces of Arabic calligraphy or pieces of Western calligraphy, and we can make all sorts of connections. That's something that I see coming together right now. in a very interesting way.
What is a tag?
A tag is when someone writes their street name, and so you just tag it with your name. And they also call the name itself a tag. So your street name is something like Chew1, a guy in my neighborhood who goes by that. And so you see Chew1 has written his name all over the place. When they're good at it, and there are quite a few good ones, they really care about the shapes of the letters. They think about the negative spaces between the letters. They think about how to lock it together. So it makes a beautiful thing that can be written at great speed. And that's almost identical to what calligraphers are thinking about.
The very first thing you said was it reminded you of Islamic calligraphy.
Yes, particularly because the letters often overlap in ways that the Islamic calligraphers do. And I think it's important to say graffiti is a completely independent tradition. It arose of its own from the streets of the cities in this country, especially New York and Philadelphia. And they created this art form. And in creating it, they actually kind of rediscovered things that people have been doing for centuries in other traditions. And some of the most interesting calligraphers today, I think, are some of the guys in Europe who came out of the graffiti tradition and then engaged with the bigger, older traditions that they came into contact with and straddle both worlds. I'm thinking of people like Luca Barcellona. He's in northern Italy. And so he became aware of the European calligraphy tradition. So he started doing much more formal work. He still does graffiti-style stuff. He can do both. Or someone like El Cid. I don't know. I don't remember his given name, but he goes by El Cid. And he came into contact with his Arabic roots, has done things in Tunisia and places like that.
That's interesting, yeah.
So, yeah, they came up through the street tradition, but then they actually tapped into something that has really ancient roots.
Yeah, connected back into
That's
it.
Right.
But it means it probably comes from the same place in some way, you know, at some level.
I think there's something kind of natural about human beings picking up tools and beginning to write with them.
Would you say that graffiti is mostly protest art or protest script? If it's done on walls and in public spaces.
You're right. At this stage, it's kind of turned into its own art form that has its own even gallery system. But yes, you're right. It is a protest. It's a statement that I control this space. And I think that's one reason they never leave any negative space within their compositions, you know, because they are dominating that space. And in order to do that, you've got to fill. So yes, it does have those very strong protest roots.
Right, because if you're then doing it in private space or on paper or textile or something, it's not the same thing anymore.
It's not the same thing, but you know they keep sketchbooks, show each other their sketchbooks and compete with each other to do better, more interesting designs. So a lot of the big compositions on walls have been very carefully worked out in their black sketchbooks.
Really?
Yeah.
So it's not more random or as opportunistic as it seems sometimes.
No, and actually someone once told me that one of the functions of the tag is to go and test out a wall. So you go tag the wall, and then you see whether the owner is going to paint over your tag. If your tag is up for a while, then you can take the chance of doing a larger painting.
It is always subversive.
Not always, but
when it's somebody else's walls, it's got to be subversive.
That's right, yes. There are also opportunities for graffiti artists to actually do things with permission.
This is really interesting.
For me now, in the last 5 years, I've really wanted to tie in looking at graffiti just the same way I tie in looking at Islamic and East Asian work, to say there are a lot of points of reference here that Western calligraphy can really benefit from looking at all of these different traditions.
Well, I'm really glad to have made contact with you.
This has been delightful. I've enjoyed it.
Good. Lovely. Thank you very much, Christopher. I'll be in touch with you.
All right.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You heard Christopher Calderhead, a renowned calligrapher, author, and teacher, talking about the history and practice of calligraphy. You can find out more about Christopher and his work at calderhead.org. You can hear Tidings on the second Wednesday of every month at 7:30 p.m. Tidings programs are archived at hazelkahn.com and produced by Tony Ernst.